This was announced yesterday with Donald Trump. And basically what's happening here is Hamas had agreed to a version of this framework that they were told by a U.S. emissary would satisfy Donald Trump. The Israelis went nuts over that. And so what's happening right now is there's an attempt to amend language. It boils down to this, Amy. Israel wants to be able to continue the genocide if it determines it wants to do so. Hamas has said it's a red line if the deal does not include a clear path to negotiations for a permanent end to the war. So what is happening right now is that there are reviews happening on Hamas's side, on Israel's side, and we're going to have to see. Donald Trump is the defining factor. Everyone involved knows that the only person capable of ending this genocidal war is Donald Trump. It's a sick reality. It has to do with his business interests in the Gulf and elsewhere and his image of himself. But it all boils down to that. It has nothing to do with a humanitarian objective or saving Palestinian lives. It has everything to do with whether Donald Trump decides Netanyahu's war is bad for his business politically and his personal family business.
We just have 30 seconds, but you've reported someone who served as a backdoor negotiator for the Trump administration is Dr. Bashar Ababa. Can you explain who he is?
Bashar Ababa was the head of Arab Americans for Trump. You know, Donald Trump tried to hit Kamala Harris because he knew that she was very unpopular because of her Gaza stance. He's been the U.S. emissary that's been dealing directly with Hamas. I'm told that often what happens is Ababa is in the room with Hamas officials. They then get Witkoff on the line or they communicate by text messages. You know, this is a lower level official, but it seems clear that that backdoor communication is what led to Witkoff announcing that there may be a breakthrough imminently.
Jeremy Scahill, we want to thank you so much for being with us, co-founder of DropSite News. We'll link to your recent reports. That does it for our show. We're hiring a senior headline news producer, a director of audience, and a director of technology. You can find out more about these full-time jobs at democracynow.org/jobs. That does it for our show. I'm Amy Goodman with Nermeen Sheikh for another edition of Democracy Now!
Hi, I'm David Brower, David R. Brower, and I add the R because there are 100 other David Browers in the United States, and that keeps me separate from most of them. I like the direction you're going in, KBOO, Portland, and I wish you had a lot more company.
Camp KBOO is in session. Sign up to support us during our summer membership drive now through June 29th. All you have to do is to check out kboo.fm/give, text KBOO to 44321, or mail us at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue and support a summer of memories together.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open meeting policy is available at our website at kboo.fm. The Engineering Committee meets on the first Thursday of the month at 7 p.m. This month's meeting will be held online through a public video conference. A public link and phone number to attend the meeting can be found on our website at kboo.fm. Please visit our website to verify if a meeting is being held.
Support for KBOO comes from KBOO members and Grendel's Coffee Shop, located at East Burnside and 8th Avenue in Portland, featuring coffee, tea, sandwiches, and more. Information at grendelspdx.com.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, an early but big victory for Oregon's Attorney General fighting President Trump's tariffs. Multnomah County residents speak out trying to save programs they say are a lifeline to the most vulnerable. And a Northwest city that once relied on timber and mining is turning to healthcare for jobs. Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Thursday, May 29th, 2025. I'm Annette Newell. Thanks so much for joining us tonight. Oregon's Attorney General Dan Rayfield scores a big win as the federal U.S. Court of International Trade rules in favor of a lawsuit he led, including 12 states challenging the president's authority to wield tariffs as a weapon in a trade war. The three-judge panel, including a Trump-nominated judge, ruled in favor of Rayfield and the other state attorneys general, who argued that the Constitution gives Congress, not the president, the power to set tariffs.
Congress has, it is an enumerated power of Congress to set tariffs. They've given that, some of that power to the president. They've delegated it. The question is whether Trump's actions have gone beyond what Congress is delegated.
Rayfield has filed other challenges against the Trump administration, including one on birthright citizenship. He says so far the courts have agreed with many of the state's challenges.
The unique part about the time in history that we're in right now is prior to the president taking office, he was incredibly open about the types of things he was going to do that were at odds with the Constitution. They were at odds with laws that Congress had passed, which really gave us insight in how to prepare for the eventuality when he would take office. So as attorneys general across this nation, we had already been working and preparing for what were going to be eventualities.
The Trump administration's already filed an appeal and did get an emergency order today from an appeals court to allow the continuation of tariffs for now as the court sort through the arguments. White House spokeswoman Caroline Leavitt struck a defiant tone.
He did speak to the leader of Japan this morning, and he said that was a very good call and a good discussion. And the president's cabinet, Secretary Lutnick, Secretary Grescent, and Ambassador Jamison Greer have all been in touch with their counterparts in countries around the world to let them know the United States will still be at the negotiating table, and we still expect countries around the world to treat us fairly. I will just close by saying that how ridiculous it is that we've have been ripped off, our middle class has been hollowed out, our manufacturing base has left and gone overseas, jobs have been offshored, and now no court did anything about that. No court did anything about hundreds of thousands of people being put out of work, about thousands of factories being closed down, about our deficits going to dangerous levels. But now a court is trying to stop a president from trying to correct those wrongs of the past, and this administration will continue to do that. It's a promise the president made to the American people, and it's a promise they elected him on. We will win this battle in court, and the president will implement his America First trade policies.
Trump is not a fan of how he and his tariff policies have recently been labeled. KBOO's Josh Salem has more on that.
Donald Trump does not seem to be a fan of the term taco. That label does not refer here to the popular food dish, but instead was coined by Financial Times analyst Robert Armstrong to describe his approach to tariffs. It stands for, quote, Trump always chickens out, end quote, and represents a reference to how markets are responding to his tariff policies. Taco has been adopted by some analysts and commentators to describe the pattern in which markets tumble after Trump makes tariff threats and then rebound sharply when he relents and allows countries more time to negotiate deals. Changes driven by Trump's on-again, off-again tariffs are becoming fairly predictable. The stock market, for example, jumped on Tuesday after he delayed a proposed 50% tariff on the European Union that he had threatened just a few days earlier. Yesterday, Trump lashed out at a reporter who asked about the label. When he was asked in the Oval Office whether the term might be a valid description of his approach to tariffs, Mr. Trump reacted angrily. Trump responded, quote, I chicken out? I've never heard that. Don't ever say what you said. That's a nasty question. To me, that's the nastiest question, end quote. For KBOO News, I'm Josh Salem.
Houselessness and kids' mental health help in schools were on the minds of dozens of Multnomah County residents. Speaking out in the final budget public hearing before commissioners settle on their spending plan for the next fiscal year. The commissioners are coping with a budget deficit as they weigh which programs to keep or cut. Here are just a few of the voices they heard.
My name is Maida Blum. I want to thank you for your time and support in the two amendments brought forward for buying back the school-based mental health program. This means more to me than I can express in words. You've heard over the last few months about the services provided by this program and the profound impact the loss of this program would have. What I don't think has been explicitly shared is the unique role the mental health consultant limited duration role provides, which is the role I hold. This position provides backfill for clinicians who are on extended leave or additional site coverage and support. This allows schools to not have a gap with no mental health services while a clinician is on leave. During the last two school years, this position has provided mental health services and support in the following schools: McDaniel High School, Jefferson High School, Russell Elementary School, David Douglas High School, George Middle School, and North Gresham Elementary School. North Gresham Elementary School is not currently a school. The school-based mental health program provides services. However, the school identified a significant need during an ongoing period of crisis. I've been able to provide consistent mental health support for the current school year.
My name is Vanessa DeWeese, and I serve as the Director of Permanent Supportive Housing at New Narrative, a nonprofit committed to helping individuals with serious and persistent mental illness thrive in their communities. I'm here today to voice our strong support for continued funding for the programs, including Douglas Fir, Cultivating Community, Bridging Connections, and the ICM program. These programs offer not only housing, but critical wraparound supports. These are individuals at high risk of chronic homelessness with many complex behavioral health needs who would otherwise cycle through institutions or be left unsheltered. Permanent supportive housing works. We see people stabilize, gain a sense of dignity, and rebuild their lives. But housing alone is not enough. Cultivating Community and Bridging Connections provide the short-term shelter and crisis stabilization that offer people a safe place to stay while they work towards permanent housing. These trauma-informed programs are essential for individuals who cannot access their traditional shelter due to behavioral health needs. They bridge the gap between street houselessness and long-term stability. Equally vital is the county's investment in intensive case management. The ICM team provides community-based, individualized supports to help people navigate extreme barriers to housing. When paired with long-term rental assistance, ICM enables some of our most vulnerable community members to remain housed and supported in the community. This work is life-changing and, in many cases, life-saving. These programs form a continuum that embodies the goals of the local implementation plan: reducing chronic homelessness, advancing equity, and expanding behavioral health services across shelter, transitional housing, and permanent housing. Multnomah County and providers like New Narrative is making real progress, but only if the funding continues.
My name is Stephanie Perry. I go by they, them, and I wanted to speak to you on the issue of homelessness. I know that the budget is very tight this year, but I want to ask that you continue support for those who are on housing vouchers. Like myself, I'm going to find myself homeless again in February, because as far as I know, that's what's going to happen. But not just in general, but I'm asking for those who are significantly disabled. I know I'm not the only person, but I am now a wheelchair user. I've had my toes amputated. I'm an insulin-dependent diabetic. I have MRSA. I've been getting skin infections for the past year, and I've been denied the permanent supportive housing vouchers, though I did get on a 12-month voucher with Home Forward. And so I would just like to ask that people who are on housing vouchers, especially those with chronic health problems that are severely disabled, have their vouchers continued rather than be thrown out on the streets in 10 months. I read a recent article about a month ago that stated that the estimated cost for a shelter bed in Portland runs between $22,000 and $52,000 a year. But in a low-income studio apartment like mine, that comes out to just a little over $14,000 a year. And I would just like to see disabled people like myself, because I've heard stories from a few other people. One woman who even has cancer, who stands to be thrown back out on the streets when her voucher ends. And I would just like you to consider some way to continue to support those who are on these 12-month vouchers, especially those with chronic health issues and chronic disabilities.
My name is Stacy Mingo. I am a native here of the city. I am also a worker, a direct service worker with Self Enhancement Incorporated. And in my job, I get the pleasure and the privilege of walking individuals from houseless to housed. I get to walk people from uncertainty to certainty. But what the problem is with this work is that us who are doing the work are like one check away, if not already needing the work that we provide. And why I'm here today is just to come with my heart out saying help is needed all around. For those of us who do the direct service, those of us who are inspiring and encouraging, we need that as well. Because how can we pour into someone from an empty vessel. We have very many of us direct service workers working two and three jobs just to make ends meet. All I'm asking is for you guys to look at the budget and put the money where the heart is, because the heart is what's helping the community. Thank you for your time, even though you couldn't see my smile.
County commissioners will cast their final budget vote June 12th. If you're looking for a job, healthcare is booming in parts of the Pacific Northwest. Isabel Charlet has more in the story.
A coalition of community leaders are connecting Spokane residents to career opportunities with the goal of building a strong, diverse economy. Washington's second largest city, which once relied on timber and mining, has seen growth in industries like healthcare, advanced manufacturing, and technology. Erin Vincent is with Greater Spokane, Inc., the region's business development organization. She says part of workforce development means focusing on young people. One of GSI's initiatives, Business After School, gives local students in the 6th through the 12th grades the chance to gain real life skills in a workplace setting.
Whether it's trades, apprenticeships, 2 years, 4 years, any of those are great options. What can we do to create the conditions so that kids can choose whatever is best for them?
Vincent says about 12 host businesses participate in Business After School during the year. She adds students get a glimpse into different careers in a variety of ways, including career fairs and visits from industry professionals. Erin Williams-Huter, Executive Director of the Health Sciences and Services Authority of Spokane County, oversees grants that support bioscience and public health initiatives. She points out that healthcare has now become the city's leading industry.
When you're in a community where so many of us work in healthcare, seeing that innovation, seeing the job growth, seeing new people being trained in that area, it's just critical to our well-being.
Williams-Huter adds the organization is addressing the area's provider shortage, particularly how long it takes to see a primary care doctor. This story was produced with original reporting by Laura Aka for Working Nation. Support for this reporting was provided by Lumina Foundation. I'm Isabel Charlet, Washington News Service.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for KBOO News In Depth. At 6, it's Rose City Native Radio. Then at 7, American Indian Airwaves. Tonight's weather, cloudy, down to 54. Tomorrow's weather, sunshine and warm, up to 83. Today in history, on this date in 1851, Sojourner Truth, a formerly enslaved woman, rose to give a famous speech in which she asserted her right to equality as a woman and as a Black American. It happened at the Ohio Women's Rights Convention. The quote of the day is from Sojourner Truth. "I have plowed and reaped and husked and chopped and mowed, and can any man do more than that?" New signs that free speech is in trouble at some West Coast colleges. Suzanne Potter reports.
A new study shows free speech is increasingly under assault on college campuses from both the right and the left. The nonpartisan, nonprofit Foundation for Individual Rights and Expression, known as FIRE, surveyed 58,000 college students, asking them about campus culture when it comes to comfort expressing ideas, tolerance for speakers, disruptive conduct, administration support, openness, and self-censorship. FIRE's chief research advisor, Sean Stevens, says threats to speech come from all sides.
It's not just left-leaning faculty or students going after more conservative faculty and students for inviting Ben Shapiro to campus. It's now like the federal government and whatever right-leaning faculty there might be left and the students going after left-leaning speech. So now you've got almost everybody facing these threats.
Six private religious institutions, including Pepperdine University in Malibu, fell into the highly intolerant warning category. Harvard scored the lowest, with USC, Pomona College, and UC Davis not far behind. UCLA and USC fell into the middling, below-average category. Schools struggled to uphold free speech rights as dueling protests overtook many college campuses in 2024. Stevens says the Trump administration's crackdown on universities and foreign students, ostensibly in the name of fighting anti-Semitism, has raised the stakes.
There's a much bigger cause for concern because it's also coming from the government. So faculty really need to step up because students are rightfully concerned that if they say the the wrong thing, that the hammer might come down on them.
The data show that around 2020, we saw an uptick in punishments for speech and expression around the topic of police violence toward African Americans. Later, other issues took center stage, including sexual harassment, abortion rights, transgender rights, and the Israel-Gaza war. Support for this reporting was provided by Lumina Foundation. I'm Suzanne Potter.
Proposed cuts in the GOP budget bill has spurred a National Fair Housing Week of action. Kathleen Shannon says people are worried about plans to cut funding for programs that help people with disabilities and veterans.
Housing groups across the country this week have declared a national week of action as federal lawmakers consider a budget that eliminates all funding for fair housing programs. Montana Fair Housing ensures housing in the state is non-discriminatory, as mandated by federal law. But Republicans' federal budget bill, which last week advanced from the House to the Senate by a single vote, has zeroed out all funding for fair housing initiative programs in 2026. Lawmakers argue groups can still apply for fair housing assistance program dollars, known as FAP, but Pam Beam with Montana Fair Housing says the state doesn't have that program.
If the budget stands as it is now, there will be no fair housing monies coming into the state of Montana. And to get a FAP, we would have to change our state law.
Bean says the group she receives the most requests from and would be most impacted by cuts is people with disabilities, including veterans, older Montanans who have age-acquired limitations, and those who've worked in the ag, mining, and timber industries. Bean adds that Montana Fair Housing helps not only people seeking housing, but also groups trying to comply with the law.
Over 13% of the folks who reached out to us last year were housing providers looking for assistance on understanding the law, on how to develop a policy that wasn't discriminatory.
Fair housing was already hit by DOGE DEI funding cuts in March. Bean says one way Montanans can have impact during the week of action is to call their representatives. I'm Kathleen Shannon.
U.S. Envoy Steve Witkoff says he's optimistic about a Gaza ceasefire. Clean energy tax credits are in jeopardy in Congress's big budget and policy bill, and the Trump administration pauses new student visa interviews. With more on the stories impacting our democracy, here is today's edition of 2025 Talks.
We are on the precipice of sending out a new term sheet. The president is going to review it, and I have some very good feelings about getting to a long-term resolution.
U.S. Special Envoy Steve Witkoff says he feels confident about reaching a ceasefire that could lead to a long-term resolution in Gaza. The U.N. is criticizing Israel's handling of aid delivery after hundreds of Palestinians stormed a U.N. warehouse in a desperate attempt to get food, leaving four dead. A top aide to Russian President Vladimir Putin says President Donald Trump's comments show he's uninformed about the Ukraine war. Trump says Russia's continued attacks on civilians make him doubt if Putin wants peace, although he's not imposing additional sanctions on Russia because he thinks a ceasefire is close. As the Senate starts work on Trump's big budget and policy bill, some Republicans are critical of its repeal of clean energy tax credits. Christian Stumpf with the Nature Conservancy says the credits were designed to channel billions of dollars and thousands of jobs into rural and urban districts, red and blue alike.
We're trying not to see this through a Republican or Democrat lens. We really think that there's a strong case to be made for economic vibrancy and supporting sustainable communities.
Tech billionaire and Trump advisor Elon Musk said he's disappointed by what Trump calls his big, beautiful bill, saying it'll explode the deficit and undermine the work of Musk's DOGE team.
I think a bill can be big or it can be beautiful. I don't know if it could be both.
This week, a federal judge has greenlit lawsuits challenging the legality of DOGE. D.C. Judge Tanya Chutkan said the Advisory Department of Government Efficiency was created without statutory or constitutional basis. The State Department has paused new visa interviews for foreign students as it ramps up screening of applicants' social media for signs of extremism. The agency says the suspension is temporary and won't apply to already scheduled interviews. In response to the mistaken deportation of Gilmar Armando Abrego Garcia to El Salvador, Maryland lawmakers have passed restrictions on actions by federal immigration agents. Catherine Jackson with immigrant advocacy group CASA praises limits on sweeps at schools and hospitals. She says residents and especially anyone born here deserves constitutional due process protections.
The 14th Amendment guarantees citizenship to anyone born on U.S. soil, no exceptions, period. This is not about policy reform. What's happening is we're seeing the Trump administration try to rewrite the Constitution to exclude certain people.
I'm Alex Gonzalez.
A whale census is underway in one of America's northernmost towns. The Rosebud Tribal president declares a state of emergency. And the Remember the Removal ride cycles from Oklahoma to North Carolina. For these stories and more, here's Antonia Gonzalez and National Native News.
Scientists and Alaska hunters have been counting bowhead whales passing by the northernmost American town, Utqiagvik, for the past 2 months. It's part of a once-in-a-decade effort to evaluate the health of the population up north and support subsistence in the area. So far, the numbers seem to be on the rise. KMBA's Alaska Desk reporter Ayolna Naiden has more.
When bowhead whales pass Utqiagvik on their way up north, it's a good time to count them. Every 10 years, scientists and local hunters team up to carry out the census for bowhead whales that migrate between the Bering, Chukchi, and Beaufort Seas. Biologist John Sitta says the data helps ensure that the bowhead population is healthy. It's also used to set subsistence harvest limits in the years to come.
We do it for the whaling captains, and we do it in collaboration with them.
First, they build a perch on the sea ice, right on the edge with a stretch of an open water or lead. Observers have been climbing the perch and counting the whales passing by since the beginning of April. The visual count is only the first step of the census. But so far, Sita says the final estimate might be around 20,000 whales or more.
There are a lot more whales out there now than what there used to be. We suspect the populations continue to grow, but we just don't know that for certain yet.
Sita says the bowheads might be thriving because the sea ice in the Arctic is declining. Whalers in the Arctic have been involved in the bowhead census since the early 70s. That's when the International Whaling Commission counted whales for the first time. Retired whale biologist Geoff Carroll co-led subsequent counts.
We're able to show that there's plenty of bowheads to support the subsistence hunt.
That initial count only included whales passing through the stretch of open water. But hunters knew that some animals traveled far from shore or under thick ice. Throughout the years, the census has included acoustic and aerial surveys that account for those whales. This year, the acoustic part of the count is also happening.
It turns out that bowhead whales really talk a lot.
The International Whaling Commission expects the final estimate in 2029. In Anchorage, I am Alona Naiden.
A state of emergency was declared this week on the Rosebud Sioux Tribe Reservation in South Dakota. It was issued by the tribe's president, Kathleen Wooden Knife. The declaration states it's due to threats posed by widespread methamphetamine and illicit drug use, trafficking, and related gun violence, which poses risks to public safety, community health, and tribal welfare. The tribe seeking increased patrol and investigation from federal agencies, cooperation from the community in reporting crimes, and urgent action to address law enforcement gaps. According to the Office of the President, this follows previous declarations issued in 2019 and 2024. 12 bike riders from the Cherokee Nation left this week from Tahlequah, Oklahoma for Cherokee, North Carolina to participate in this year's Remember the Removal ride. The cyclists will join riders from the Eastern Band of Cherokee Indians for the ride, which officially begins next week. The ride spans about 950 miles along the northern route of the Trail of Tears in Georgia and ends in Tahlequah on June 21st. The ride honors Cherokee ancestors who were forced to march in the late 1830s. Cyclists will visit several Cherokee gravesites and historic landmarks along the way. Their journey will be posted on the Remember the Removal bike ride on Facebook. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
Finally, this week brought the day where we pause and pay tribute to those who made the ultimate sacrifice for our country. We also heard lots of speeches on Memorial Day, including this one from Oregon U.S. Senator Ron Wyden.
I'm very pleased to be up here with Cliff Benz, the congressman from the area. It is not an atomic secret that we have some differences of opinion on issues, but we're Americans. We're Americans first, and we talk. And that's, frankly, what it's all about here. That's what we talk about. We're Americans first. Now, we remember those who are no longer with us and who always wore their uniform with pride. Military service in America is a tradition, and I think it's worth noting that this is the 250th anniversary of the United States Army, the Navy, and the Marine Corps. 250 years, folks, a pretty good run. 80 years since the end of World War II, 50 years since the end of the Vietnam War. Enormously important milestones, and we're thinking about them today. But I suspect a lot of you are thinking a little bit more about the loved ones that you miss today and you think about when you hug your families. You talk about treasured memories. And I suspect, because I'm on the Intelligence Committee, so I'm up on secrets, there's a tear or two shed. I also join you in a way that I think something of a bond. My parents fled the Nazis in the 30s, not all got out. My dad was one of the famous Ritchie boys, the German kids who fled the Nazis, talked their way into our army, and dropped the propaganda pamphlets on the Nazis. I'm very proud to be my father's son. I also wanted to say that my dad would always say on Memorial Day, he was able to come home to America because so many of his fellow service members paid the ultimate price. So it's thanks to the soldiers, the sailors, the airmen, the guardians who fought fascism alongside so many of your relatives. That's the reason we have democracy here at home now. I spent my weekend watching democracy in practice. I had town hall meetings. People can just say anything they want, whether they're left, center, wherever they are, they say whatever they want. And I thought, in much of the world, they don't have meetings like that, folks. People don't get to say what's on their mind in much of the world. So the people we remember every day sacrificed their lives, their futures, their dreams, so that all of us could have the freedoms I saw the last couple days, the freedoms of speech, the freedoms of assembly. And I'll close by putting it in the context of what Cliff and I deal with back in D.C. Back in D.C., people talk a lot about, throw around the words war and battle, and I guess that passes for differences of opinion in D.C. And yes, there are big differences of opinion. But I'll tell you, and I'm sure Cliff feels this way too, the wars and battles of politics don't compare to the actual deadly war and battles that your loved ones went through far from home. And they didn't go to war as Democrats or Republicans. They went to war for all of us as Americans. It's their sacrifices that let us gather where we want, when we want, and make sure it's free to all of us to say what we want. That is an amazing legacy, an incredible legacy, and one that so many paid for dearly on battlefields. So as we remember loved ones, you have our empathy and sympathy for your loss. You've got our thanks because our country and state